Hi, welcome to the Spotlight Report. I'm your host, Logan Graves. This is a monthly podcast where we dive into topics that pique our interest. They typically cover optics and science, but honestly, they can be quite broad. You can find out more about the Spotlight Report and find all of our episodes, as well as comment or like the podcast, on our new location, which is on the ELE Optics Community Forum. That location is community.eleoptics.com, and you'll find the Spotlight Report there. Thanks for listening.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was fine. This is a Spotlight Report.
Sure. Let's
okay.
Go.
Okay.
All right. So this week on the Spotlight Report, I am interviewing Henry Kwok, who is a third-year graduate student in the College of Optics. He is in the Loft group, pardon me, which is the research group that I was in. I went to the we did some research projects together. Henry, I mean, I don't need to belabor it, but I thought that you were an excellent researcher. We've kept in contact with a lot of fun. And you recently spoke to me and said that you had comps coming up, which you passed. So you're in your third year, and this is kind of a key transition from my recollection, being very focused on classes towards going to, you know, the role of a full researcher. So when we spoke, you had said that you were fairly stressed about comps, but also somewhat stressed about the idea of when you graduate, what research are you going to be doing? How do you make that transition? And this was interesting to me because I looked back at my journal and after we had talked tonight, I was trying to think, how did I feel at the time? And for people that have met me when I was in grad school there, I had a cynical take on grad school, but I had gotten more optimistic by the end. So I read my journal, and on an entry in my third year, just prior to taking the comps, here's what I had to say. Quote, "I have been stressed and unfocused and unable to feel satisfied about research for about a week and a half now. Still having trouble with research and feeling adrift and uninspired about. I can resolutely say I, expletive, hate my research. It is seemingly pointless, but God forbid the march for more papers halt to allow for a talk discussing what constitutes worthwhile research. Or maybe I just shouldn't be a researcher." Close quote. So I surprised even myself at how cynical I was. And it was really interesting to me because I think it's taken for granted how hard grad school is mentally on students, and how much you kind of have to work through and figure out. You know, I think you and I have spoken before. We had Chase on, Eddie LaVilla as well was a guest, and many other people have spoken about the issue of mental health as a grad student that's kind of undervalued. So this is interesting to look back and see that I think I can say I was not in a good mental health position. And I you know, thought a little bit more about it and realized, you know, you're going through the very least same setting and scenario, except you're doing it with the added stress of this being during COVID, and you aren't able to go into the research lab, which has a lot of implications too. So without further ado, after that long monologue, I'm curious, how are you doing? You know, where are you at? And I want to hear what it's like now, not only as a third year graduate student in and around comprehensive exams, but what is it like now with the added difficulty and stress of doing this all with COVID?
Sure. Thank you for having me and introducing me, Logan. It's great to be here on the Spotlight Report again. And just a first initial reaction to your journaling diary from around kind of where I am right now. I just finished most of my coursework. I was fortunate enough to pass comps, the written and oral. And now I'm on this path of being an independent researcher, I guess. The way that my meetings with my PI, day work, has evolved is, you know, now I check in with him and tell him what I think rather than asking specific guidance at all time. And he'll give me feedback when I ask for it, as well as pitch in what he thinks, rather than me just being totally lost, not knowing the norms, being unfamiliar with literature, what we've done, what we haven't done. I kind of know this now. And then I just have, you know, I just have a bunch of ideas. I know how to execute on them. And for that reason, it is even to greater discomfort because I know I'm fully capable of doing these things and that there's nothing standing in my way. For example, when I came in, when I was a wee lad in my first year, I was under your tutelage, you know, I'd be afraid of words like H-bar and coma and astigmatism. But now having taken a bunch of classes and discussed these in detail and gone to office hours, talked a lot with lab mates and people not belonging to lab, you know, I'm not afraid of these words, understanding what they mean and their implications, but the pressure just mounts as into what's expected because these are no longer obstacles to my research. I am the obstacle to my research. And so waking up with that every day and knowing that I have to confront it, I guess that's the primary challenge of a PhD, or that's so I'm thinking. You know, I've asked this question to a lot of people, and they being PhD candidates as well, or I don't know, and that's fair. Anyone who will ask who has a PhD will have given their survivorship bias. So for me, I've stopped asking and just kind of accept that the PhD will be whatever it ends up being for me, because it's different for everyone. And so going back to your original question, I'm just left alone with just these goals to, of course, the endless march towards publications, as well as this, you know, the realities of trying to execute on my ideas, because, you know, I have to execute on novel things, test novel things, sometimes go into lab. It can be an obstacle, because how often do I want to expose myself to COVID, right? Every doorknob I touch, every passageway I walk through, that's potentially some exposure. And it's this weird shift now too, because I have a mentee where I was the mentee just 2.5 years ago. And, you know, like, I don't know if you felt the same way, but now I taught someone how to use, and I'm teaching someone how to use the interferometer. And I'm like, you know, when I did this with Logan, I recorded every single thing and never watched it again. And the person I just mentored recorded every single thing. And I wonder if they'll ever, right? Because grad school just kind of comes at you, and you learn things that you need, and you think you're going to document things that matter. And perhaps they do matter, but like, you're not going to have time to go back for them. You know, every plan that I formulated has just been beat back by reality. And I'm not even saying that in a negative tone. This is just as objective as I can be. It's just, I would say this as, it would be a lot easier without COVID, because as you're doing things, other people in lab see you struggle or see you try different things, and they give their they might be able to help you, or you might be able to bounce ideas back and forth, echoing until you find truth. But obviously that can't happen. It's limited to how often people visit a shared Zoom room. And so you explicitly have to go out and seek your own question, which is good, which is part of the process. I will say I've reached out more often than necessary, because now the opportunities to discuss ideas are only presented when you look for them, rather than just being the right place and right time. It's not as important. Right. And so perhaps research is halted in that way, which I think research is, I mean, it's, you're trying to become an expert in a specific very niche field. And the way you do that is not by talking to your PI on one-on-ones every week, every 2 weeks, every month, but talking with your peers who know just as much, but maybe are focused on different things. Battling it out and arriving at truth, perhaps those battles will educate you better eventually when you're the lone scientist or the lone optical engineer at some company, and you're the only person who can turn to it. Your word is truth. And if you screw up, it's on you. And so, you know, the ability to become that sort of researcher, that dimension taken away.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned, you hit upon a big thing, is responsibility becomes kind of a driving concept around the stage you're at. So let's take a step back as well for the people who are not as familiar with the grad school and the College of Optics. So you spend your, actually, why don't you go ahead and describe what the process is loosely to graduate. As a graduate student from start to finish, what is it like? What are the stages?
So the formal graduation requirements are a number of classes, which might optimistically take you 3 years if you do full course load, and then maybe a half course load at the very end. You also have to pass a written exam, which tests you on 4 core subjects, which are E&M, geometrical optics, diffraction and interference, and quantum mechanics. After that, you should be familiar enough with your field of intended research that you can write a short summary paper, what you intend to research, whether you've done it or not, and then defend yourself in your expertise or familiarity with that in a verbal discussion and presentation over about an hour and a half. After that, you'll be doing the research in which you're developing novel contribution, whether experimental, simulation, proof-based, to advance whatever niche dedicated. And after enough publications, which is dictated by your specific optical subfield and your advisor, you might have the chance to propose your defense, write your dissertation, live happily. So that's process, I think, should be between 4 and 5 and a half people.
So it will, and we'll give, to give added context, it's heavily dependent on your, I think the average for optics is 5 years. That being said, if your intake, I think the average is like 7 years. And if you're in different engineering fields, or if your friend whose girlfriend is in grad school for English, and another one who, or I had another friend who was in grad school for philosophy, but 5 years was the short end of this. So grad school can heavily vary, but for the College of Optics, I'm willing to say that 5 years is like a good amount of time, and that if you are beating 5 years, that's unique. Four years can be kind of like a, so you are in your third year and you just took the comprehensive exam, passed it. And then you also, and what else? What was that process like? You took the comps and you also defended yourself via the oral exam.
That's correct. Could you clarify what do you mean the process of that written and oral? What was that like?
Yeah. So what is it? I mean, why is it for people outside of the College of Optics grad school, the comprehensive exam and the oral exam is really done. It's like a really big, stressful, unpleasant to some people, to me anyways. And it's because your first 2 years, from my recollection, please, comment if you feel otherwise, but the first 2 years that I was in school, you're constantly learning new advanced topics. You have a lot of people around you who might be better at these topics or might be particularly skilled in one class. For example, that's electricity and magnetism. To give a funny story, or I found it anyways, when we took the exams, the average on them 80%. And there was consistently one student who would score between like a 95 and a professor would make a point of saying, look, this isn't an impossible exam. Somebody understands it. And to make matters worse, the student who did so well was a very, very young grad student. I think he was about 17. So it was extra egg on our face. But you go through this process of learning a ton of stuff. And then at the end, there's an exam. And it tests you on the four key subjects. And you better get it right. Because if you don't, you failed, right? You either pass or you fail. And that, to me, was a very stressful process. So why don't you comment on that first?
Sure, I can totally comment on that. I still remember it very vividly. So that exam is very daunting in that it's just four subjects. It's the four major classes you took in your first year. Everybody comes in from different backgrounds, such as physics, electrical engineering, some mechanical engineering like myself, or people even from optics colleges. And the pressure mounts because, if you're from an optics college, there's so much pressure to automatically pass. You get to know your peers very well. And there's this thing where like after you pass, what if you don't? Right? What if your peers do and say, oh my gosh, that was horrible, but at least we passed. And you have to live through that for another year until you can retake it or retake part of it. That's horrifying. You want to coast off the momentum that you've already built. But if something, it's not standardized, but it's this discrete bar, you have to make it over. If you don't make it over that bar, who's immune to these self-judgment, right? It's really tough to stay focused on future coursework if you don't have the confidence from some silly exam. Of course, it's meaningless because it's just exam take. It did matter to some point. You'd have to retake part of it. And so, that whole pressure, it's really crazy. I've seen people postpone a year because they were unable to take it on that very last day, whether it's due from stress or other extenuating factors. That has an impact on you perceive your entire next year. That living through that is not easy.
Yeah, and you phrase it well. I think that it turns into this weird comparison to your peers, which I think is kind of made up. Not that it's not valid, but students do this to themselves. They're detrimental. If you have good peers, they're your friends, regardless of. And I think most of them are. But it's easy to get in your head and think like, oh no, I'm now separate from. And the other part of it is, you've spent your entire life and career trying to get to this point. And if you fail it, wow, like, why am I doing this? I spent all my life just for this and I failed, which again is a silly and not realistic outlook. I think it's something. But that being said, you made it past that and you went to the oral portion. So can you explain what that oral defense, I don't know the exact term, so oral defense, oral exam, whatever it's called. Can you explain what that looked like?
Sure. After you've passed a certain number of classes and passed that initial written, you are able to petition a committee, which is four members representing three different subfields from optical engineering, optical physics, imaging science, and photonics, and representing three, at least three of those areas to take a look at the field that you want to dedicate yourself. And they just review what you have prepared in a presentation about your field of research, whether it's on stuff you published or plan to research in and have done none of it, that's totally okay. They just want to probe you with certain questions to make sure you know what you're talking about. For example, when I began talking about the infrared wavelengths that come from certain watery, vaporous clouds in distant galaxies, they'd ask me about Fourier spectroscopy, even though I had no idea the details of that, and just made sure what a Fourier transform is, what's the difference between spatial resolution and other types of resolution. And, you know, do you know what interference is? You should know by now. You've passed this certain exam. Or what's the sensitivity to this particular parameter or instrument that you're using to measure your measurand of interest? They're just making sure that you can talk coherently, and I guess you can represent the field well, and that you're ready to become an independent reader. And so I felt they probed me for 2 hours. They, to go into a little bit more, if I had spoken completely uninterrupted, I would have been around 28 minutes, but the entire process took about an hour and 28, because after every question, I would get hammered with specific questions asking if I knew what a certain term was. For example, like, what is a lens? And people are like, oh, it's used to focus light, but actually it's a quadratic phase mech, right? And so there's certain things that are fun questions for them to ask. You know, to me, this was a big day, but for them, this was Tuesday, right? It was another day for them, making sure somebody knew what they were talking about. But right. After they've extinguished all their questions, the conversation kind of faded towards the 1 hour and 20 minute mark, and I just kept talking. They felt fairly confident and gave me helpful contributions as for directions for my research and comments to explore if I actually knew what I was talking about. And that actually really helped me with my, it was a great discussion between four experts of different fields whom I might not talk to every, it was fantastic.
Yeah. And not only might not, I think, well, you know, I'm commenting for myself, not for you, but I wouldn't have. I would not have sought out these random professors, my oral, and casually said, hey, here's my work. What do you think? Give me some critical feedback. But yeah, I agree with your description. And I'm going to try to describe my perspective going into it, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, and then my perspective now and after, you know, after I passed, after the stress is gone. But going into it, I had done a lot of research. I had done research on deflectometry specifically. If the audience listeners don't know that at this point, man, I'm not doing my job very well. But I'd done quite a bit of research on deflectometry. I'm conversant in deflectometry, and deflectometry is 0.001% of us, right? So I now have to go and speak professor who is world renowned in quantum optics. I have to speak to a professor who's world renowned in geometrical optics, a professor who's renowned on polarization, experts, like absolute experts, which comes with, you know, the nature of the College of Optics being kind of a world-class institution for this, but it's really daunting. I have to go and talk to them and defend what I'm doing and look like basically competent, right, to them. I remember I had asked Daewook if I could blacklist a professor, not because he's a bad person or anything like that, but he was, as are basically all professors, he was just devastatingly smart. And I was terrified that he'd ask me a hard question. And I remember Daewook saying, like, no, of course not. Why would you blacklist anyone? I don't think that's a good idea. He wasn't on this professor. So that was going into it. It was absolutely terrifying. You know, the smartest people I can think of in fields I don't really know, even though, yeah, I've studied, are about, does that seem about accurate from your
100%. Okay. In fact, one of my committee members, Dr. Ewan Wright, was just, one of his papers had just been selected to be the top 50 cited in physics in the last like 3 decades. And I was like, this was like 2 days before my this comprehensive oral defense. I was like, oh my gosh, I got to brush up on optical physics. And that was entirely.
Right. And Ewan, for our listeners, taught me anyways quantum optics. And he is undoubtedly just one of the delightful. Did you get a chance, by the way, to ask him about the latest papers showing that the speed of light was broken?
Unfortunately not. I was too terrified at the end to make
That's
any
That's probably
sort of-
good that you didn't. It's a pet peeve topic of him. But anyways, I digress. So it's daunting. It's terrifying. And you're in a position that everything rides on this. These, you know, people that you probably aren't casual good friends with, they're judging afterwards. It was fantastic. I mean, I got such phenomenal insights from Dr. Brian Anderson, who was the quantum and physics heavy side of things. Everybody on my committee was extraordinarily generous with their time. This is my perspective, right? Post. They are very generous with their time. They just fantastic feedback. And my takeaway was like, wow, these professors are helping me to do really good research. And I could comprehend that a part of it was like, you know, if you're really not there yet, then they would give you the feedback of like, look, you should probably touch upon these topics some more before you dive headfirst into research. But because I didn't experience that, my whole takeaway was like, this was just a great opportunity to get feedback from these experts. And it felt very kind and generous. So it's funny to me how totally different I looked at it afterwards. Is that, what do you think?
I think that's totally accurate. I would say that my initial terror was dampened, unlike yours, because, you know, I would consider you who's gone through a very similar trajectory that I would hope. And so I talked to you within weeks before the exam, that helped calibrate my expectation that it would be terrifying, but knowing that level of terror is helpful towards your level of nervousness during the, and so I think I was slightly less terrified than you were. And I kind of knew what to get out of it going in, because rather than coming in seeing that they could take so much away from me, I was coming in saying, hey, you could give me so much back. So I came in with that attitude, and it helped dampen.
Right. Which I think is such a great perspective to have, if you can have it. We've spoken to Isaac, and of course, Noah. Isaac, his typical sage mode, he on his own went into the oral exam with that perspective. Like, man, this is great. They're going to help me at a whole discussion. You know, for anyone listening that is going to have to take an oral, I might not be exact committee members, but I encourage you to try to take that perspective. This is probably a kind thing. They're not out. It's a discussion amongst peers, and it'll overall help your research. The other thing that I'll say is bring a bottle of water. This is what I tell every grad student. Bring a bottle of water. If they ask you a question, take a sip of water and think about the question before you answer, because it's very easy to run your mouth and overanswer. So after you finish that, it's smooth sailing, Henry, right? You're done. I mean, you just have to do some research and you're out of there.
It's crazy to think that. Well, for some background, right before, I took four classes in the last semester, which is absurd because I took two polarization classes, which each had 10 assignments and not trivial homework sets. I was taking a math class called Opti 604 Advanced Mathematical Methods, and it's all about orthogonal polynomials, pseudo-inverses, SVD, and wavelets, and all sort of stuffs that I kind of lost.
And I warned you about this class. I want the audience to note, I warned you about this course.
He warned me several times. He reiterated. I said, is this the class I shouldn't take? And he was like, emphatically, yes. And what did I do? I took it because I'm a goon. So I took it because reasons. And then I also took lens design at the same time. So in overall, I had 43 assignments that semester, and I got very little research done. But the stunning thing is now, after having passing comps, I feel like for the first week, I got even less done, because in front of me is just a single class, optomechanical engineering. And you know, this is something I already feel a bit more comfortable with, because I'm coming from mechanical engineering. Despite this, I'm getting even less work done, because this weight of self-expectations is weighing down on me. It's crazy. I don't have a science. I'm taking a class that I'm already a bit familiar with, and I'm not terrified. Yet I feel like, you know, the work is there. I have to do it, but it's a road I don't want to go up. It's like you're walking up a mountain.
So what is that? What do you have to do? Right? Because it's understandable. I think that this is a key thing for people to understand. Your first 2 years, the comprehensive and the oral exam, that's concrete, right? You take these classes, you take this exam, you defend yourself, and that's what you have to do. So now what do you have to do?
It's your guiding me to the right point, because you've got to make that up. You've got to judge for yourself what steps those are going to be. And not only what those steps are going to be, but how you're going to evaluate how well you did on those steps. For example, in the field of metrology, our goal is to make novel measurement solutions. But how do you measure something that is groundbreaking? You've got to cross-validate it against something that can already measure the crazy optic, like a freeform or a crazy A-sphere or convex sphere you're trying to examine. And, you know, you have to figure out how you're going to measure something. You have to figure out if people will actually trust that. You have to figure out during COVID, how you're going to get access to that equipment, how to be safe if you're working with your partner, what you can feasibly do inside a simulation, what will work, what won't work, who's available. For example, someone I want to talk to in OEFF is in Korea right now, and they're gone until February. And so I kind of have to
And what is, sorry, just to interrupt, what does OEFF stand for?
That is, I think, the Optical Engineering Fabrication.
Okay.
That is the world-class team of optical element fabricators and testers who make stuff like the GMT segments, DKIS, so I think the Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope, tons of stuff. And so some of those experts, you really got to reach out to them. In a normal research day, you could casually go on an adventure, walk downstairs to the lowest floor and just talk to them. But now you've got to reach out, you schedule. And, you know, the PhD is becoming this, I would say it's still a blend of just, you're learning new things, you're finding out new ways of interpreting things and regurgitating, explaining to others, which is a huge part of your education. But now it's this whole process and you can still go down that road, but you've got to plan it out. You've got to schedule. It's not so
simple. Right. And I like your description a lot. And I think that at least for me at that stage, what I had to do was graduate. And in my mind, how I thought I had to graduate was papers, right? I don't know if that's how you feel as well, but that was kind of the things that I thought that I needed to accomplish. And you phrase it extremely well. How do you judge what papers to do? How do you judge how well you wrote a paper? How do you know if you're writing the right papers, graduate, et cetera? Like it shifts from some relatively objective metric about pass-fail towards a very subjective defined by yourself and your advisor, because you have to have that conversation with your advisor of what do I need to do to graduate? How many papers, and et cetera. So is that accurate as well for you?
Totally accurate. Okay. Coming in, I was like, hey, I have 3 papers because my PI said this is a standard. But in especially in the recent past 3 months, like, well, will I get what I came for the PI? If I just write 3 papers, can they be on anything? Will they be meaningless, interconnected? Will they be more if not interconnected? And so, yeah, those are great points, and I'm still learning.
Right,
I'm 5 semesters in.
Right. Yeah. Well, I hate to break it to you, you'll keep learning. Unfortunately, that's the even post grad school, I am probably learning more than I was in grad school. But so have you? Well, this is a 2-part question. A, how do you decide what research you're going to do? And then B, have you decided that? That is, like, what are you working on now?
I guess for figuring out what. Well, I figured out kind of a Willy Wonka analogy to figure out what I want. You know, for me, I would say at the beginning of my PhD, I'm walking into this factory whose lights are out and I'm looking for 3 golden tickets in the dark. I don't know what they are, but I need 3 of them, at least 3 of them, to get to the exit, to qualify to get to the exit. And that exit would have just been defined as you need 54 units, 18 dissertation units, and to pass these certain exams, pass oral defense. But it's not so simple. I would say the first couple of years are kind of like you're building a flashlight to learn around the area you want to see and see if you can see more of those golden tickets. And so seeing that way has been more illustrative. And what I've seen so far is that once you become familiar with a certain part of the room in which there's actually tons of tickets everywhere, the whole room is made of tickets. All right. But you learn which ones are worth taking, as in, you know, it hasn't been done before. It's cool. It's part of your skill set, or potentially could be within your reach, and you decide to go for it. And it'll be a ton of work because no one's ever done it before, but then you've got to do it. You decide to do what is most interesting to you because it's going to be painful. Writing is painful. Doing correct tests is painful. Using correct methods, painful to get right. And so that's kind of how I'm seeing it right now. As for how do you go about deciding what you want to go to, you know, at the point of a comprehensive exam, I feel like you should be familiar with enough with your field such that you can identify these golden tickets that are up for grabs. You know, you'll still be pulling and tugging, but it, you know, it's there. And so that's kind of how I'm seeing. And I'm in that tiny corner or edge of the room right now where I see a couple of things that are potentially within reach. And so I've gone after them because they look painful, but, you know, based on my background and what I know, who else will it be to uncover that and put it in the literature? It's who else wants to make an optical mechanical budget for deflectometry except me, right? So
right.
It's got to be me.
So conversely, though, to summarize, at the time that you took your oral exam, you know these quote-unquote golden tickets, you know the topics you're going to have to produce original research for and write a paper to graduate, right? That's the ultimate. So what's What are the risks? What are the downsides? And I can see and I can remember many about a research project. But I first want to hear what your perspective is.
Could you elaborate on that more? Like,
well, yeah. So let me. I'll just share what I thought about it at the time. First of all, I can choose a research project. I'm going to sink a lot of time in. Not only is my own time a name to some extent writing on the quality of the research and the quality of the output, but so is Daewook's name. So the advisor, pardon me, is both of our advisor. So is the lab's name to some extent. And so there's the aspect of quote unquote pride writing on. There's the aspect of what if I do something wrong and it gets published and that's, you know, revealed, then that's like catastrophic. I didn't worry about that too much. The biggest thing I worried about was I'm going to get scooped. I'm going to spend a bunch of time doing this and someone else is going to publish it right before. That's more so what I was always worried
about. I can comment on that in that I am similarly afraid. And I've decided to live life on the edge, always on the precipice of, you know, sheer joy and sheer absolute dread, in that you can go to Google Scholars and you can place an alert on certain keywords. So I finally mustered the courage, because I've known about this for a long time. I set my main keyword of research, deflectometry, to pop up from Google Scholars. So Google Scholars has this cyclic scanning and it tells you when something new has come out. And I used to, you know, kind of baby it, in which I check every 30 days to see if something new came out in D, because I knew it came from a couple major labs who do work on this, some from Germany, some from China. And so only recently did I say, all right, you can't do this anymore. You got to face the music and always be kept up. So now I put it Google Scholar to alert me whenever something where deflectometry comes up. And when I see an email to me as an icon on my phone, I'm always having a heart attack because I'm, oh my gosh, it's happening. I'm getting scooped. What I've worked on for a year and a half is going to get taken away. I mean, that's the only way to live. I mean, it's good because you'll read every paper that comes up, such that you'll become a more familiar researcher, and perhaps you'll get better ideas, or perhaps dreadfully, you'll actually get scooped and have your novel be published before you by the institute. Mm-hmm. But there's no way around that. Everyone's at risk. They're trying to be the factful, and your only counteraction to that, you've got to make something super novel, which decreases the likelihood of you getting scooped, but that's just added pressure on you. It is this fatiguing process.
And it's funny because, I mean, it's funny to me, it's probably not. After I graduated, and more so when I was in the last year, we were working on the IR project, I knew I was going to graduate. So I didn't feel pressured. That pressure of like, man, I must get these projects out. I must get papers written, converted to that very overused phrase, but unfortunately is applicable, which is, you know, switch your mindset from I have to I get to. And it happened organically for me when the pressure's off, right? When it's like, I'm going to graduate. People seem to respect my work. So this is awesome. I get to work with a mechanical engineering expert who can craft a custom box and help me out on this project. I mean, this is a lot of fun. And if someone in that mechanical engineering person for the listeners was Henry. But, if someone, quote unquote, scooped the project, that didn't seem worrying to me, because that's cool. I thought infant deflectometry was really exciting. And if somebody did something else that, you know, somehow perfectly aligned, awesome. I want to talk to them. And, you know, what's the next thing that we do? So when there's nothing writing on, I think that research takes a totally different perspective. And that being said, I want to add the caveat, I like writing a lot. So I liked writing papers, which is its own strength. But when you're at the stage that you're at, there is a clear goal, which is to complete grad school. And to do that, you have to do these papers. So it's almost, there's just an absurd amount, right? Which I think delivers us nicely into kind of the topic that we get to, which is at that time, I worked through deciding a project. I would go into lab, set things up, work on it, spend far too much time watching NBA basketball games with my old lab mate, Cal. And eventually we got results and I write up a parent's pub. You cannot do that. So I don't want you to put your work in jeopardy of getting scooped. So without saying too much what your work is about, can you comment how you're accomplishing research at this point?
Sure. I would say right now, I think the best, most motivating way of framing my goal is that recently I've been interviewing with a couple of companies. They'd asked me about my becoming optical metrology. And so it's scary because when they talk to me and they're not from the field, they listen to me as if I'm the expert. And the reality is I will be there. And it's terrifying to me that if I say something is trustworthy, they'll completely have faith in me. And if something goes wrong, it's completely. So what's more terrifying is that I'll go out of the PhD, but potentially 3 papers in maybe an unbelievably short amount of time and still know nothing and not get what I came for. So I'm regarding this next full phase of being a research associate, which is, I guess, what they call you after you've passed the comprehensive exam. It's just a stage of learning. You know, what did I come here for? I wanted, one, to become an interesting person, two, to become a world expert in something. You don't really get to have that second part if you don't talk to as many smart and interesting people as possible while you're still at this college. So for me, you know, I'm reading a lot. I'm trying to talk to more people or summon the courage, as well as talk to the people in my lab because they may be great. For example, Hyungmo, who is a 5th year in our lab, one of the gods of optical design. And I constantly refer to him when I don't know something because I trust him blindly, which I shouldn't, but it's good. You know, trusting him blindly is usually not a bad choice. So, you know, I'm for research, something I'm considering that he's going to be graduating soon and I'm going to be a senior. And that's terrifying because people will be coming for me for help and I have to know these questions. So the process of research is constantly reassuring myself to know what I'm doing, to know if the devices I'm using, which I'll cite on papers, are actually worth something, right? And so I go back to these tools in which I think I could have blindly trusted and actually questioning them. So I've been making a lot of tools for myself to see if they're worth their weight. So research at home is difficult because I'm a hardware guy and I'm testing a lot of my own setups with things I design in 3D print. You know, I'm measuring things that I 3D print, making full setups to make different measurements, which are built on my initial primary measurement instruments. And so this is what that kind of looks like. I'm going to share a couple slides on what that looks like. If you can enable the screen share.
So this is quite exciting. We get to do a live demonstration of the difficulties of doing research in COVID. Let me see. Advanced sharing options and all participants. There you are. You should be set up.
And it's not going to be a full screen share. It's just going to be the PowerPoint slides. It'll be fine. So it's just a couple of pictures I put together. Does that look like a PowerPoint?
At home tools, it looks like a PowerPoint to me.
So one of the things that I was resistant to coming to optics was, you know, can you 3D print things to mount things? And the answer became yes, because more often than that, I've seen papers with things hot glued to mounts. And I figured that 3D printing would be okay because it's more mechanically designed than a bunch of hot glue. And so this is my own 3D printer in which I print stuff at home. This is something I bought. I used to be a 3D print technician and I used to look over 50 3D printers. And that's why I bought this one because I know how to fix it, calibrate it. For example, in 2020, I had 347 unique prints. That's how many I counted, things I designed and just made fixtures for. And these aren't even duplicates, just unique prints. And so the problem with 3D printing is that you don't know if a print is going to succeed or fail. And then over time, you just have to learn based on product geometry, how to design something, how to resize a hole, because you know whether it's coming out at the side or at the bottom, at the top, just those slight nuance. And when you 3D print something, you want to measure it with calipers. For example, this cube is on the right. It's a 20 millimeter by 20 millimeter. And I print it and calibrate it such that it comes out by 20 by 20 every single time. And how you do that is you print a really, really big piece, which might say, hey, you know, you designated 120 by 120 millimeter, but it came out 121 by 119. Well, what do? You recalibrate the motors and stepper drivers to interpret a different scale factor for how many steps you take per what you tell it to, how far to go. And so I calibrated the ellipticity to 1/1000. I figured out a method to get really shiny prints. And this indicates that your bed is flat. And I have yet to measure this, but I've got it down pretty consistently. So I can get pretty specular things with this. I can print things that are circular to 1/1000th and not be an ellipse, because that's important because I print mass for some lab mates. And so that's just one example. I have to have this down to a science. I have to know how to print something because it's going to take 8 hours and I don't want to repeat that. And my PI is meeting with me in 10 hours. I better get it right. And it's happened quite a bit more than I liked. Something that happens often is kinematic couplings, in which if you want highly repeatable measurements, you have to be able to create quasi-kinematic repeatable structures in which you have a ball that can only fit into, let's say, 2 flats in a specific way. And if you constrain 6 degrees of freedom, well, you get something that goes in the same position every time you put the ball into the two cylinders. And so using about $6 worth of hardware from McMaster Car and some pre-weighting mechanisms by just heavy steel posts from Thor Labs, I got a repeatability of about 47 arcs. So you design, I designed something in SolidWorks, puts together, glued it together. And then I put a laser onto this and then stared about 4 meters away and then just repeatedly violently dropped this back and forth, the balls into these, I guess, cylinders. And then I got a bunch of dots on this grid of paper and got the RMS, I guess, centroid between all, you know, and it'll deviate every single time because I touched some of the balls with my finger, which leaves a little bit of grease. But that was pretty good. And I use these pretty consistently now. And someone in my lab uses this design. So I had to completely, I had to completely like figure out how to do this and get a methodology that works. And that's just for one assembly. I built a polariscope in which, you know, sometimes you need to, well, I didn't buy it, by build a polariscope. I mean, just do mounting and assembly. So I have a pretty Lambertian source. It's a drawing pad that acts as a unpolarized light source. I've got a polarizer, linear polarizer from Thor Labs. And then I've got a couple filters in which I can put wave plates or other polarizers and just put a cell phone, like in the middle picture, that's a cell phone mount, so that I can observe the birefringent, an optical element, and maybe see if something is, it's come up before, but I've had to identify if something is plastic or glass. And rather than putting a soldering iron to it, I'd rather do it. The plastic would see a lot of internal stress and induce retardance. So building that is actually a pretty big part of my arsenal now. So how about tools, right? Like, how do you know if this is called a laser distance measure. And these are really cheap. You can get it for about $40 on Amazon. What you do is it's a laser that points at a surface that scatters and some of the light comes back and is taken in by a huge lens, right? A lens laser, and it calculates the time of flight and divides it in half. An avalanche photodiode, which is at the very end of this and is responsive, rising edge mode up to, you know, hundreds of picoseconds, you know, that's going to be your minimum error. I wanted to test if this was actually accurate to 2 millimeters, 1 millimeter, because this is a pretty convenient way to see how far things are in an optical setup. So I had to build this stair step kind of calibrator in which I use different distances to see if I could actually trust the sensitivity, also absolute accuracy. And, you know, these manufacturers were actually all right. They were accurate within 2 millimeters. And ultimately, you cannot beat the response time of the photodiode, which is why they're stated uncertain. But that was good to know because we had been blindly using these. And how can you publish without the confidence of your measurement basic instrument?
Which I want to interject here, happens a lot. The uncalibrated or unchecked of things are published.
And as
a paper review. So I just want to make that comment.
it's scary because, you know, I've read papers in my first year, reread them my second, and I'm rereading them now, and I can understand them more, and I have even more questions for the author. And I guess that's a sign of becoming paranoid, and I guess what you do when you become an expert of something, you're becoming an expert. It's rightfully so, we're doing these.
Right. And you're trying to measure, when it comes to optical metrology, you're trying to measure stuff on meter scale, which I don't have my analogies down anymore, but it's, you know, fractions of a fraction of the width of it. So if your things are uncalibrated to millimeters, that doesn't bode well, right? If you're trying to get that kind of...
That's correct. Even little things, like if I'm using a rotation station, there's some famous experiments that were used in the 90s and also the 80s. It wasn't published in the 80s, but it was in the 90s. You know, where you can use a rotation stage to measure, to remove many, many systematic errors. However, what happens if your rotation stage doesn't move in discrete intervals? What if 60 degrees that you told the computer to drive your motor was actually 59.8? How does it affect it? Well, you can't really trust it, right? What if you have something wrong? Right? If you're actually off a little bit, you get some high frequency errors, which is something you absolutely cannot have for the crazy optics we're trying to measure. And so with that, I was not even able to trust the motors I used to use. And I had to build this entire, on the right is just some encoder chips that supports 4 encoders that measured up to 0.02 degrees accuracy. And I had to set up this thing that was robust and reconfigurable between my systems just to monitor open loop what I told a stepper to go to and what actually, how far it went. And this was super useful because I learned it wasn't, in fact, going at certain discrete steps. You know, there was variance over time. There was so much variance that I couldn't trust. And now I just do open loop recording at the exact position something moved to, rather than trusting blindly that it rotated discrete steps. And so that was horrifying to me, but it had to be done. Building this tool took like a literal week because I had to think about how this could go. I had to self-calibrate this too because I had to use two encoders from the same manufacturer and put it on the same shaft and see how much they deviate over a large run. It was nuts, but it had to be done because you don't know and you don't want to, you know, there's just that potential guilt if you publish something or misinterpret results. And I don't think I can live with that. So yeah, just building a tool to help my setups. I get maybe that's a part of the PhD. You know, for example, Logan used to talk about building his own I guess pipelines for figures that were automated, just because every time he wanted to present something new to the PI, you don't want to redo the figures every single time, you have that automated. And so I'm not quite there yet. I'm not where he was, but I will be soon. I think it's building these tools saves so much time, and I'm learning how to. Lastly, we reached actual deflectometry, which is, and so this is just a simple setup inside my house. You know, it's got a screen, it's got a camera, it's got the test optic and a laptop. And so I've got this huge desk in the middle of my living room, just test setup stuff. And I wish I had another picture, but all of the technologies I've been using go for a single measurement. Cause I don't want to go into lab. If I go into lab, I have to split allocated lab time with other people, cause we don't want one or two people in the same room at the same time. It's not great. So the best way to move rapidly is to do it inside. And so that's what it takes. That's what research is during COVID, to be at home, to be a hardware person. You've got to build your own tools so that you can access your hardware anytime. You have to make sure all your tools work. And then, you know, it's hard because someone, your lab mate's not going to walk in and say, hey, you should watch out for that. I'll say this from my experience. To ask them for that. And you have to, I don't know, it's taken a lot more vulnerability. We're lucky that our lab, the large optics fabrication and testing group, we have very open hearts and we help each other. You have to serve and get them to come out of the way. They don't casually pass by. But yeah, that's what I had to share about. I'll leave it back to you. That was a long tirade.
No. That was exactly what that's all very impressive work. And I think you're lucky that you closed the share screen. I was going to put you on the spot and ask the deflectometry is, but that'd be a little unfair at this point. So what I do want to say is it's clear then from the hardware perspective what's missing or what's different. You have to make your own hardware. You have to evaluate. And you don't have a lab mate casually popping their head in and saying, you know, why is it set up like that? That actually might not work. Oh, don't trust that rotation stage. Who knows how it is? Which was something that I had, right? I had these peers. I had their comments. I knew which means not to trust and trust. But what are the intangibles that's something that I'm quite curious about. And that's an open-ended question. So I give you a little more details. One example is, you know, friends in lab were a huge motivator to A, go into lab and B, to do research, because you could go set up your experiment and then talk with your buddies. And it was fun to set up the experiment. And then you could complain about it or get a beer with them and talk about it and you get feedback. And that's what I would call an intangible. So what of those has changed?
Totally. You know, one would think that PhD is this highly technical process, and it is, but it is even more so is that it's a creative process in which you think outside the box and you're not working in the back. You're not working between yourself. First, you're working with the people you talk to, their ideas, your discussion of those ideas from peers, with other peers. And it's just this constantly evolving train of people talking about what would be cool, what hasn't been done before, because realistically, you're not going to get creative ideas that are contributing to a field. You're not going to get them easily if you don't try to constantly explain them to people, justify them, you know, be open to criticism, look at other people's, you know, criticize those, offer help with those. Those things really jog the mind. Just being able to be on campus and, you know, go for a walk, go for a coffee, come back. That I think creative space is missing. I would say it's a demand that is certainly, as well as just people to encourage you to take it. You're in this act. You're mostly alone unless you're on a Zoom call daily, and it's hard to pace yourself. Where other people are always nicer to you. They've often got good advice. They care about you. You know, when you're alone in the vacuum in a room, well, you don't know whether to push forward. And if you push too hard, you might lose the momentum for the next day or the next week. And you don't really know that. Part of the experience of grad school and becoming of this world-class researcher practicing being in this environment where you talk with other people and not only focus on your thing, but help people with their stuff too. Because so many cool publications have come out of, I don't know, cross-pollinated experiments, right? Like people who've discovered amazing things learn that they walked across to the lab next door in a different department and found the solution sitting right there. Who's to say that, you know, I mean, that discussion is really your PhD, I think. I think talking to my peers, and I guess, I mean, you didn't come to university just to be on Zoom to do experiments. That interaction is what drives innovation. I don't know if that's, yeah. Yeah. I would say interaction is pretty intangible.
Yeah, I think that's a really deep insight, and it's something that is probably was highly underappreciated. And I think hopefully, you know, to take a very morbid thing, but hopefully this is an improvement after it, is that there's a greater appreciation of human aspect to things, even as foolishly stereotyped as like robotic, but as, you know, an engineer or scientist getting a PhD. I think there's a trope that there's no creativity in it. There's no human, you know, humanity to it. People at this level are very robotic, and that's just dumb and wrong. And what you're saying is really insightful. You know, that's kind of one of the key drivers of this creativity and innovation. So I would say from a very personal perspective, it's been interesting. And I'm not complaining. I don't have anything to complain about, but it's been interesting for me during COVID to be reminded by my girlfriend that I'm a very extroverted person. So I used to love just going and talking to people at lab, right? And then obviously after I've graduated, I used to love going and working in a coffee shop or getting that interaction with your peers, and not having that has to be very challenging, particularly with the added stress of grad school, even unrelated to research and accomplishing research. But it looks like you have innovated quite a bit on your own for working around that and working around research. I know that you and your group, or Daewook anyways, told me that you guys have frequent Zoom meetings, and they sound fairly fun, as much as a Zoom meeting. So I think that about sums it up for this portion. I don't want it to end on too morbid of an, so I'm curious, not necessarily to have you defend, you know, grad school, much less grad school during COVID. Are there positives? Is there anything that's fun or that's made it, you know, exciting or during this time?
I mean, of course, that element of reflection is very nice, where in retrospect, you can value your peers. I don't want to justify COVID with a silver linings kind of argument, but I will say that I will certainly value my peer interaction. And then just being able to work at home was very illuminating in showing how much actually, because going to lab can make one feel like one is doing things. Well, actually, you were just on the same Word document for 6 hours, and at home, that really comes. So that was kind of nice and eye-opener. But that's all I really had. I think a lot of stuff would have, more cool stuff would have.
Sure, of course. And I'm certainly not trying to defend COVID. But more so, I guess, for example, it seems like, you know, if you're in grad school, I don't know, it seems, well, maybe not. Maybe there isn't a lot that's just objectively there to be positive about. It's just stuff that you have to work through right now. I would say at least that your setups are quite cool. I'm not the one setting them up, so it's easy for me to be excited about them. But yeah, okay. Well, with that, the other portion that we usually do is the overrated versus underrated. And so the way that this works is I am just going to ask you about a topic or an idea, and tell me if you think it's overrated, underrated, or accurately rated. And if you want, defend it, but you don't have to. And as I always say, I completely stole this from Tyler Cowen's Conversations with Tyler. So without further ado, why don't we start off with playing the piano?
Underrated. Very cool. Very fun. A lifetime hobby. Just because you started when you were young doesn't mean you should quit forever. Go back to piano, folks.
Yeah, I started to learn it, and I really haven't been quite as rigorous in keeping up with it, but I will say that it is a lot of fun. Okay, the next one. This is going to be a bit of a harder one, but I think I already know your opinion. But the author Vladimir, and I'm going to butcher his name, Vladimir Nabokov, who for our audience members was his most famous book is Lolita.
I would say he's accurately rated by experts on America. I would count it as he's accurately praised as one of the people who write absolute gems of literature. And so I cannot call that under, but I cannot call it overrated either, because I've read two of these books and I just immediately want to reread them, but I don't have accurately read.
Yeah. And I think you already know I think it's overrated, but I need to give it an honest attempt. All right. Well, to stay on that topic, how about Camus, the author, who again,
Camus is an possibly existentialist, but more absurdist writer. He talks a lot about a philosophy in The Guest, The Stranger, and The Myth of Sisyphus.
Particularly applicable right now.
Yes. And so he goes over a lot of themes about, is it worth living? What is the meaning of life? And he sort of approaches it, I honestly might say. So I say he's overrated. A lot of people defend nihilist versions of life, but I don't think that was what he's going for. I liked a lot of the ideas. And I certainly think if I were to if I highlighted one of the books in person, I would have highlighted a quarter of the books. Still, I think it's overrated.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
What was your take? I want to hear.
I think that I think The Myth of Sisyphus and therefore Camus is greatly underrated. I think that his other books like The Stranger and Plague and the ones you listed grossly. I reread The Stranger. I didn't like it that much. I can say a lot of negatives about it, but I don't really need to. But at the same time, I think that The Myth of Sisyphus is like just a devastating, remarkable book about like introspection for, you know, if you are in a hard spot or if you're not even in a hard spot, why are you doing anything, much less what you're doing, and forcing that introspection of like, well, if you're doing it, you know, everyone has their own takeaway, but I just really found that quite valuable. And it's really short, a little bit tired of life. That was to switch gears a little bit, how about Taylor Swift?
I don't want to alienate your audience.
You should give, let me do this actually to give you a little bit of a free runway to express yourself. I think that she is highly overrated. So I've alienated my audience. And now you should feel free to say what.
You know, every band, once they've hit superstardom, every artist, once they've hit superstardom, they do what they want, which is great. I think that's the ultimate goal of the artist. And I like country Taylor Swift and early pop a lot more than edgy. I would say right now, I think she's...
I would agree with that. I liked some of her early entry stuff. I can't do it. I just don't particularly like her music. That being said, you know, I'm not saying that she's not a phenomenal artist or a very creative person or independent mind. And I also will give the clarification that I have terrible taste in music. So my opinion doesn't mean very much. We actually had some recommended listeners. So one of the questions said that I should just outright ask you about phenomenal cooking, but I want to get this in the phrase of an overrated underrated. So how about this? Following the recipe when you are baking, overrated or
underrated? Totally overrated. Like if you've read any cooking blogs, they're like, oh, put a pinch of this, let a clump of coriander fall from the harbor of your palm. Like, what is this? Like, why do you do this? Like, here's the thing though, like baking. When the American calibrated oven is probably off by 25 to 50 degrees, what does it matter? Like you need to, first of all, calibrate your oven, okay? Get a real thermometer, make sure your thermometer is doing the right thing. Make sure your thermometer is for measuring liquid or solids, right? Who cares if you added a pinch too much salt? Like it's also an art in experimenting, which is I think why people tell such personal stories in their cooking. It's a very artistic and personal thing. And your taste will, you know, if I felt good when adding 2 tablespoons of sugar instead of 1.5, something great happened that day. I'm going to keep going with that forever. And it's going to taste sweeter to me. It would have straight from the recipe. What? Deviate. Go ahead.
Yeah, I can't agree strongly enough. I think that the joy of cooking and baking is making something as you see fit. So I often don't follow the recipe. I'm glad to hear you say that, though. Baking, usually people on baking are very, very by the book. And I don't know. Who knows how many people will take your advice to calibrate their cooking instruments. I kind of like. All right. Well, maybe the last one. It's not even going to be overrated or underrated. It's going to be Harrison. Do you think that the Marvel series is better than Star Wars?
Speaking of
alienating the audience, this is really putting in the hot seat.
You know, with I think Jon Favreau taking such a huge hand over both series, they're getting to the same level. I think that's wishy-washy, but It's hard to say. I would say both are being Disney-fied, for better or worse. And you see a more well-calibrated version of an excellent film, which will get better reviews. But I don't know about the risk-taking about future years. It's hard to say. Some risk-taking has been good. I would actually say all the risk-taking has. But who's to say that risk-taking will continue for both franchises under the hand of capitalism? Who knows? I don't know. I'd say both would buck under the same trends. Can't say.
Right.
Both ail from.
Yeah, I like that answer. All right. Well, I don't necessarily have any more overrated or underrated questions for you. If you have any parting thoughts, if you have any advice for listeners or else you want to comment on, please share it. But otherwise, that's all I got.
No, I hope you were able to cover what you wanted, and I hope that I provide some perspective of someone doing hardware stuff in COVID. I've expressed myself as honestly and vulnerably as I could. I'm surprised you didn't get more into the sheer dread of grad school in your experience, but I think I just have to think about your comments and ask you for exactly, explicitly, what you wrote in your journal. And upon rehearing this podcast, I think I'll hear that.
All right. Well, I'm sure at some point after things have settled down some more, maybe COVID is quite pressing, we can sit down over and I can read my journal to you.
Oh, I would be so happy to hear that.
All right. Well, thank you for doing.
Thanks, Logan.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Spotlight Report. As always, we invite you to go to our website, community.eleoptics.com, where you can communicate and discuss this episode of the podcast and find all other episodes of the podcast, as well as other useful information. Thanks. Have a great day.